From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember the great jazz pianist and composer Jackie Byard. He was murdered last week. Byard played with great warmth and humor. His playing connected the rhythmic fun of early jazz with the harmonic complexity of the avant-garde. He played with Charles Mingus, Eric Dolphy, Ross and Roland Kirk, and the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and led his own groups. And we're proud to say he composed the first Fresh Air theme. We're listening to a variation of it now. We'll feature a workshop he recorded for us back in 1980. And our film critic John Powers will review My Name is Joe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The great jazz pianist Jackie Byard was murdered last week. He was found at his home in Queens, New York, shot once in the face. He was 76. Police are investigating and say they have no suspects yet. Jackie Byard played with great warmth and humor. His playing spanned the history of jazz, from stride piano to the avant-garde, and was informed by classical music as well. Early in his career, he played with some of the most important people in modern jazz, such as Charles Mingus, Eric Dolphy, and Ross and Roland Kirk. After Duke Ellington's death, Byard took over at the piano for the Ellington Orchestra. Byard led several groups of his own, including a big band called the Apollo Stompers. He also taught at the New England Conservatory of Music and the Manhattan School of Music. Something that barely registers as a blip in his career had great significance for us here at Fresh Air. He composed and performed the first Fresh Air theme when we launched our national program in 1987. We played that theme and its variations on every show for about 4 years. Why did we ask him to write our theme? Well, when Fresh Air was just a local program, we played his records on the show all the time. And his playing and composing had exactly the qualities we wanted in our theme, the contagious rhythms, exuberance, and fun of stride piano, combined with the dissonances and adventurousness of the avant-garde. This is the recording that I think best captures what I mean. Here's Jackie Byard's interpretation of Jelly Roll Morton's Chicago Breakdown. So you get the point. That's the kind of sound we wanted in our theme, but tone down just a bit. Here's the theme Jackie Byard wrote for us. Working with Jackie Byard on the theme was an honor and an adventure. Fresh Air executive producer Danny Miller and I worked closely with Jackie while he was developing the theme, and none of us had any experience with theme music. Danny's in the studio with me. I remember you and I drove out to Hollis, Queens, where Jackie lived, and we sat around his piano and kind of talked with him about the things that we wanted. We put a cassette machine on the piano to record what he was playing, and he came up with a few sketches that we really liked, and we took them home and listened back to them. And we came back a couple of weeks later to work with him some more, and we said, oh, the thing we really liked is, you know, the one we did this and that, and he couldn't remember what he'd played, and we had to play it back for him. Because, you know, he's such a great improviser and such a not theme house kind of guy.
Well, in fairness, we did say, you know, play that banging thing at the beginning. Play that clustery thing. You know, when you brush the keys, you know?
Oh, do you remember what it was like in the studio when we were trying to record the exact times that we needed for each version of the theme. We needed a 56-second version and 89-second version for the close, and then 29-second cutaways.
Yeah, I do. And I remember it was a really long day, and I remember that Jackie was really swell. Remember, we had this fairly complicated little 56-second piece of music that had to go just absolutely perfect, you know, because this is the music you're going to hear every day for the show, and we, of course, are very obsessive about getting just the right take. So Jackie would perform the theme, and it would be like this absolutely terrific take, okay? And everybody in the studio was saying, Jackie, you know, that thank you, that's exactly it. And I was the guy that had to be looking at the stopwatch and say, you know, that was really a great take, but it was 56 and a half seconds long. You know? And it was kind of loony to be asking a really great jazz player, like Jackie Byard, to, like, pay attention to the half second. I just, by the end of the day, I really felt like, man, just let the guy play the piano.
I want to attest to the fact that there's nothing in this world that can make you feel more square or more absurd than standing with a stopwatch next to a great jazz improviser saying, it's 2 seconds too long. Do it again.
Yeah, well, in this very studio that we're in right now, Terry, I once had to ask a Rolling Stone to surrender his bottle of Jack Daniels.
That
made
me
feel pretty square, too, but I guess that's off the topic. So anyway, Jackie would have to keep doing retakes of these themes because, you know, we were a half second off. Or one of the themes that he recorded for us has this kind of opening piano glissandi, and that's when you take your fingers and rub them across the keys, and it goes up a whole octave. And you actually have to do this twice. And I remember it's like getting like to take 45 or 57. It's like, you know, Jackie, can you do that one more time? Because we're a half second off. And I'd feel like a total idiot here. At one point in the session, he said, you know, I'm not George Shearing. And I think by that he meant that his type of playing wasn't, not that George Shearing is not a great player, he is, but that Jackie's type of playing wasn't that perfect take every time exactly to the specs of the time. But that is, of course, you're going to get variations each time. So we put him into the situation where variations really aren't what you wanted to get. You wanted, like, the exact thing that was written down on paper, played, you know, without any deviation whatsoever, because the timing was so critical. At the end of the session, we left with some really good tape, and it was a real thrill to put it on when we started the show.
Yeah, and I guess we just both felt so ambivalent about having the honor of working with Jackie Byard, but also being the people who had to kind of fit this ebullient spirit, this great improvising spirit, into this little bottle of the specs for a theme. And I think we both felt thrilled at the chance to work with him and very ambivalent about what we had to put him through to get to the place that we needed to be. But we loved the music we ended up with. Why don't we play the 90-second closing version of the theme that Jackie Byard came up with for us? In 1980, 7 years before Jackie Byard wrote our theme music, when we were a local program, we invited him to do a jazz workshop on our show. We wanted him to talk about his music, demonstrate the styles he draws on, and basically think out loud for us as he played. We're going to listen back to excerpts of that broadcast. I asked him to demonstrate the influence of Fats Waller on his playing.
Well, basically, he used tenths in the left hand and chord, you know, tenth on the first beat, chord on the second, tenth on the third, chord on the fourth. Then he would automatically go into playing a single note on the first beat and a chord on the second, single note on third, fourth. That's to say this. Tenth, chord, tenth, chord, tenth, chord. So on and so forth. Or single note, chord, single note, chord, so on and so forth. Single note, chord, single note, chord. I'm going to use part of the my composition. It's called John Arthur, and it depicts the piano of that era, piano playing of that time, in which I explained about Pete Price, and I remember Pete Price playing. I'm going to use some of the tools that Pete had used in one of Fats' tools. One of Fats' tools, he'd use that a lot, and I use that in this composition. You'll hear it. The intro is going to be a little rough, but... Don't you hold nothing out on mama, which is very characteristic of Fats. He was also a buffoon. And the lyrics talk about, look here, Rufus, don't do nothing over on you. Here's the melody of it. It's very interesting.
Jackie Byard, recorded in 1980. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today we're remembering jazz pianist and composer Jackie Byard, who was murdered last week. Jackie Byard played with Charles Mingus in the mid-60s and appeared with him off and on until the mid-70s. Here's a 1963 recording Jackie Byard made with Charles Mingus. This is the Mingus composition, 2BS. Thank you. Jackie Byard with the Mingus Band. Charles Mingus was a brilliant composer and bass player, but was one of the moodiest and most unpredictable band leaders. In the liner notes to a Mingus reissue, Jackie Byard wrote, "To think back over my years with Mingus is to relive a panorama of rhythmic excitement, tranquility, frustration, turbulence, love, hate, erratic social behavior, political rhetoric, and lots more." In Jackie Byard's 1980 Fresh Air visit, we talked about Mingus. I asked if playing with Mingus affected his playing.
No. See, I wasn't, I was the same age as Mingus. And I wasn't younger than him. So I was in the same category that he was in. And when I did go with Mingus, play with Mingus, is when he had, I think he had Johnny Coles, Clifford Jordan, and Eric Dolphy, and there was me, of course. We all had our own albums out. I had two albums out, and Eric Dolphy had two. Johnny had a couple that he had recorded with Gil Evans. Cliff Jordan had some out. So we were already, I'm going to speak for them, too. We were already musicians in our own right. So we actually didn't get anything from him musically other than the experience and the joy of playing with him, and by having that tenure with him, the experience was good. That's about the best thing we got out of it, and the exposure.
I wonder if you think your piano playing affected his piano playing at all.
No. No, he's always been that. It's funny, he used to play piano. I always have to tell a story. We was at the Five Spot. And he used to play piano. He let me play bass, see? So I played the bass. And so this went on for about 3 or 4 months. So all of a sudden, I start getting these bass players. Don't know what I'm talking about. I started to get blisters on my fingers. And I started to skip around. I go, look at the boom, shoom, and all this, do all these fancy things. And the night that I did that, that's when he said, that's enough. That was the end of him playing piano, the end of me playing bass. He stopped playing piano, and I stopped playing bass.
Can you play us a Mingus composition?
Sure, yeah. Let me see. Peggy's Blue Skylight. Played it for about 5 years. That was one of his favorites.
Jackie Byard, recorded on Fresh Air in 1980 when we were a local program in Philadelphia. We'll continue our remembrance of him and hear more from that session in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our tribute to jazz composer and pianist Jackie Byard. Also, film critic John Powers reviews My Name is Joe by the British director Ken Loach. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're remembering the wonderful jazz pianist and composer Jackie Byard. He was found murdered in his home last week, shot in the face. Police are investigating. We're remembering him today with excerpts of a workshop he recorded for Fresh Air in 1980 when we were a local program in Philadelphia. In 1987, when we went national, we commissioned him to write our first theme music. What we loved most about his playing was the way he embodied the history of jazz from stride piano to the avant-garde. In 1980, I asked him if he could demonstrate the stride piano style.
Well, the left hand. The left hand goes something like that. Of course, that's Brahms, and of course, today, we go into tenths now. We play tenths. We play tenths, since the 20s. He started to use it. Jelly Roll Martin started to use it back there in 26, 27.
Give us a sense of how a tenth sounds when you're
tenth
using it.
Tenth is this thing here. And Jelly Roll Martin used that in his... Chopin used it, right?
Monk used it in Blue Monk.
Everybody, the way this piano has developed, it's amazing. Here's something that Jelly Roll played. He played it. First he played the bass note, then the tenth, then the tenth again. See, and that's the way a tenth sounds. Let me see. That's what you do. octaves, play with the octaves, and you'll play with the... I know myself, when I become involved in playing, I switch around in duplicating those particular styles.
James B. Johnson is the person that's really associated with the beginning of stride piano. Can you show us a little bit of what he did?
Sure. I'll start here. Typical James P. Jones would use this here, or a tenth. Or he'd use the tenth with here. Willie the Lion Smith, is Duke Ellington, Basie used to use it, Tatum. A lot of the pianos that come up in the 20s and the 30s use that type of bass accompaniment, using the single finger and chord, or the tenth itself. And so on and so forth.
We're remembering jazz composer and pianist Jackie Byard, who was murdered last week. Byard had a knack for taking corny pop tunes and reworking them so that you'd hear something in the tune you'd never heard before. In 1980, I asked him to surprise me with a pop tune that I wouldn't associate with jazz.
The last thing I did as far as popular tunes is concerned was a couple of Burt Bacharach. I've left the whole scene, that pop scene, the past 6 or 7 years. However, there is a tune. I do this now. Yeah. I do this, and it's not popular now, but it used to be.
Thank you.
Now, that's the last tune, popular tune, that I've dealt with.
You see, you amaze me. That's a song I really don't like. It's called We've Only Just Begun.
Yeah,
you don't like it. That was beautiful. I love the way you play it. That's the kind of song, when it comes on my radio, I'm switching
you ready
to another
to turn?
Station. That's right.
I don't know why. One of my students had the melody because they're playing in clubs, you know, and they had to learn, and they asked me, what would you do with this? This is a couple of years ago, when it first came out. I said, who does this song? Well, the Carpenters. Oh, I said, oh, yeah. Who composed it? Some guy named Paul Williams. So I finally found out who Paul Williams was. I said, oh, okay, so all right. Well, I used that tune, and at the end, I usually shout out, I'm going into my Aretha Franklin thing, and I just keep on vamping the end and keep on playing a blues thing, then go back to the release or something. And like I said, that's the last tune, popular tune that I've dealt with.
Jackie Byard, recorded in 1980. We'll hear more of that session after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering jazz composer and pianist Jackie Byard, who was murdered last week. We're listening back to excerpts of his 1980 Fresh Air broadcast. Jackie Byard had a very open mind about music, and he was able to find things that delighted him, even in music many jazz musicians might dismiss as pure kitsch. I asked him how Besame Mucho became part of his repertoire.
That tune, the inspiration of that tune comes from playing some Bach inventions and some Baroque music that I was checking out. And I wanted to do something in that vein, and I ended up doing something else, which is on the record. But usually during the performances, I'll go into maybe a little Bach situation or a Baroque thing. And the left hand itself was part of, I saw this, I'm studying this something by Scarlatti, and he had used something like that, whatever it is, and he was using bass and then chord three, see? And I heard it, I said, and it happened to be in D minor, so I thought of that tune, Besame Mucho, which I've been playing ever since the song came out, and I found out, too, that Besame Mucho is sort of an international famous song. It's synonymous all over the world, and I remember going to Australia once and going to Spain, especially. I never realized the impact it had on the audience, and how the audience, regardless of who you follow anybody, they'll listen to you. And if you play this particular tune, it always goes over big with them, you know? And it does have nice connotations. Besame Mucho, I love you, or something like that. And I try to say that to the audience, you know?
What makes me laugh is that it's such a corny, melodramatic type of song.
Yeah.
Why don't you play it for us?
All right, the things you can get out of it. The first thing was... I might go into many other things, but then we'll start it off. So there's that bass I was telling you about by Scarlatti. But we make a little impressionistic. And then we play the melody. I love this song. This. me a chance to really do. I get bluesy then. Something like that. Actually, the composition takes about 3 or 4, maybe 5 minutes sometimes to get going at a performance. Here, I feel a little uptight in performing it because maybe it's because I'm going through this type of situation trying to explain things when I should really go ahead and play. But actually, it takes... That composition takes me about 5, maybe almost 10 minutes to play.
You seem to really enjoy the cliches of a culture's music as well as its incredible innovations.
Oh, yeah, there's so much you can do.
I mean, you've probably listened to Ferrani and Teicher and Roger Williams as well as Chopin and Duke Ellington.
Yeah, well, look at Frankie Carl and the crew. Frankie Carl and Eddie Duchin, because I remember listening to all these musicians when I was a child.
Did you hate them when you were a child, or did you like them?
No, it's something that we listened to. It was part of our culture then, it seemed. I remember I used to listen to Eddie Cantor, and every time he used to go on a summer vacation, he'd sing a song, I love to spend this, I'd cry, because I hated to see him go off the air, you know? That's me, I'm a kid, you know? Coming up with that was the culture that I came up in. Listening to the radio, Fibber McGee, Molly, the whole bunch, you know. And, of course, at night, we'd listen to Ben Burnie, Isom Jones. I listened to the whole crew. And then you'd have Eddie Duchin come on, as I said before, and then Frankie Carl. Who's another one? Carmen Cavallaro.
Oh, yeah.
And all these guys, believe it or not, they had the little influence of Fats in their way, Fats Waller. See, because Fats Waller was more or less Bill Evans is today to a lot of the young fellas. They all come to me and they all like Bill Evans, see, or the Red Garland or the Bud Powell or the McCoy Tyner. Well, then it was Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, and that's the way those guys were playing, you know, so we listened to them.
Now, you're not supposed to like Carmen Cavallaro or Eddie Duchin, right?
Huh, they're good piano players. Oh, you know another nice piano player I like to watch? Liberace. He's a tricky guy.
What'd you get from watching Liberace?
Well, I remember I recorded something, and I thought I had the most original situation in life. And I turn on the TV one day, and he's using the same type of thing, obviously because he had gone through it in his days. And it's this type of bass line. I don't know if you heard it. Now this bass here. I can't do it like he does because he's grinning usually and looking out at the audience. But he was using that type of bass. I thought I was the hippest thing on the market when I did it. You know, I thought that I was the only one that knew it. And come to find out that a lot of piano players used to play that style of bass, you know. So that's why I never more or less laugh at the gentlemen, these other people that have become commercial success, because they're great, because they've studied a great deal to be where they, you know, to do what they're doing, you know.
Jackie Byard, recorded in 1980 when Fresh Air was a local program in Philadelphia. 7 years later, when we went national, he wrote our first theme music. He died last week at the age of 76. We're so sorry that he's gone. Our thanks to George Blood of Delaware Valley Digital Media for helping us to restore the tape of Jackie Byard's 1980 broadcast. Jackie Byard performing his family suite from his 1991 CD, recorded at Maybeck Recital Hall. Coming up, John Powers reviews Ken Loach's new film, My Name is Joe. This is Fresh Air. My Name is Joe is a new film by British director Ken Loach. The movie stars Peter Mullen, who won the Best Actor Prize at Cannes last year. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
These days, our movies and TV are made by people who live and work in the more affluent bastions of L.A. and New York. Not surprisingly, they don't feel comfortable telling the stories of ordinary working people. That's why our TV programs are crawling with lawyers, emergency room doctors, and wisecracking yuppies who belong to the media. And that's why You Got Mail took a classic movie about two shop clerks and turned them into a bookstore owner and a mogul. For the creators of our mass culture, anyone who isn't a success has got to be a cop. As for everyone else, who cares? The British director Ken Loach does. For more than three decades, this 62-year-old electrician's son has been telling stories of working-class life. This wasn't exactly a cynical career move, and Loach has had to battle just to get his films made. But over the last 10 years, this great champion of the left has hit a commercial and artistic stride with movies like Riff Raff and Raining Stones, which capture essential truths about working people while giving us stories the larger public can care about. Of all his movies, My Name is Joe is probably the most accessible to American audiences. It stars Peter Mullen as Joe Kavanaugh. He's a recovering alcoholic, hence the title, who's been on the wagon for 10 months. Like so many men in Glasgow, he's unemployed. And he spends his time doing odd jobs and trying to hold his life together. One day he meets Sarah Downey, that's Louise Goodall, a middle-class woman who works in a community health center. Sarah turns out to have a distinctively non-bureaucratic sense of fun, and the two begin a romance. But their future darkens when Joe's dim friend Liam gets in debt to a local gangster in order to buy drugs for his junkie girlfriend. Joe is torn between helping Liam, whose problems could destroy him, and pursuing a sensible course with Sarah, whose love could save him. But he's aware that their relationship moves between moments of closeness and retreat, as when he surprises Sarah with a gift.
What's this?
Did I?
Why have you done this? What have you bought this for?
Because I love you.
How can you say that?
I can see it because I'm here.
Joe, we've only known each other for 4 or 5 weeks. If you knew me, you wouldn't do this. You wouldn't be saying this.
What do you mean?
Oh, I can't take that.
What?
I don't want it.
I'm not taking it, but no, it's for you. I got
Joe,
it for you.
I don't want it. Take it. I just can't handle it.
What have I done wrong? Sarah!
If you had a bit of trouble following that, don't worry, it wasn't you. Much of the dialect is as thick as a mouthful of haggis, which is why the American print of the film thoughtfully provides subtitles. The movie's opening 45 minutes do a memorable job of capturing the texture of Joe's world. Loach shows us the good-natured bantering that Joe's mates bring to tasks like wallpapering. He shows the class differences that make Joe and the middle-class Sarah such an unlikely couple. And he shows how hopeless unemployment has led men like Liam to plunge into the abyss. I can think of no American director who could capture so easily or so observantly the way that working people actually behave. But as with many of Loach's films, the first half is stronger than the second. He tends to set up interesting situations, then descend into political lecturing, as in the recent Nicaragua film Carlos Song, or to turn complicated material into overly neat stories. My Name is Joe gradually starts resembling an old 30s movie from Warner Brothers, which was known as the Working Man's Studio. As Joe gets mixed up with crooks, the movie turns into a well-worn plot about theft, revenge, and 12-step recovery. And naturally, Sarah gets pregnant. Still, most viewers won't mind the dwindling originality, because by then Loach has made us care so much for his characters. We find ourselves rooting that Liam won't be killed, that Joe will somehow stay sober, and that he and Sarah will have a future. What holds the movie together is Mullen's performance. Like so many Loach protagonists, Joe is an idealized embodiment of working-class nobility. Yet the movie fails if we think that he's larger than life. Mullen does a superb job of steering between the mythic and the prosaic. He makes us love Joe for his tenderness, good humor, and generosity, while letting us see that beneath all his brave decency, he's prey to darkness, anger, and a sense of defeat. At once honorable and desperate, Joe is something you won't be seeing in an American movie. An alcoholic, trouble-prone, out-of-work man who's also a genuine hero.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, last century's communications breakthrough, the telegraph. We hear from Tom Standage, author of The Victorian Internet, then The Technology of Tomorrow, with Neil Gershenfeld, director of the MIT Lab's Things That Think Consortium. Join us for the next Fresh Air.